Robin Hood Radio welcomes you to David Freeman's Science Insider with your host, the senior science editor of the Huffington Post, David Freeman.
Today was a really special treat. It's very exciting to be here. I have as guest America's, I guess, best known and I dare say most beloved astrophysicist, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. But let me ask you another question, going back to the idea about Mars. If you were offered a one-way trip to Mars, and I'm going to ask you...
I'd ask, what's the point of one way? What's the point of it?
The point is to become a colonist on another planet. Is that held any...
No, but I don't see any point of a one-way trip.
Let me
put it another way.
The return is less likely. Let's say
Let me say it another way. They're misunderstanding the concept of a one-way trip. The one-way trips in the era of the great explorers were colonies were being established.
Right.
Colonies were being established in places where explorers had already put the place on the map and was able to tell you, yeah, there's air to breathe, there's fruit on the trees, there's bring this winter coat, and here's a shovel and some hammers and nails, go at it. Oh, by the way, if it doesn't work out, come back. That's different from saying, here's a spaceship that is only designed to go one way. And by the way, when you get there, there's no air and there's no water. You'll have to find it somewhere and you have to ask us to ship it to you. This is not the same thing. So make it a round trip. You stay as long as you want. I don't understand the urge. I don't understand the point.
Right.
It's a mystery to me. Why that's some great, great advance in space exploration. I don't get it.
Do you take these initiatives seriously about colonizing Mars?
I see it as an important test of interest in such an idea. Whether or not I think they're realistic is not as important to me as the fact that such organizations exist. And people are lining up to participate.
Very eager.
Right.
Very eager to do that.
By the way, people will line up to put their life at very high risk if the reward is something that's never been accomplished before.
And this would be that. I mean, this would
it
be...
It would be that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let me change topics here because we're out of time, but I can't talk to you and not ask you about the article that was in Parade recently, in which you talked about your experience as an African-American scientist. Can I read this to you, your response here?
Oh,
it's something that I thought you had been not really super eager to talk about previously.
Yeah, I wasn't, nor did I talk to them about it at all.
Oh.
They went into my memoir, written in 1999, and extracted from a single chapter in that book. So, no, I didn't talk to them about it at all.
So,
people feel some major urge to say, oh, he's a black scientist, so let's have part of the conversation be about being a black scientist. And I never initiate such conversations, ever. And in fact, I decline every single invitation to speak during Black History Month. If you only think of me during Black History Month, I must be failing as an educator and as an astrophysicist, if that's the only context in which you think of me, to come by during February, but not March or January or any other time of year. By the way, if my professional identity involved strong racial issues, then I'd be unfair and unrealistic to decline such invitations. But I never talk about it, ever.
Right, that's why it surprised me to see that, because I've heard you say that previously.
They felt talk about it. Compelled.
Mm-hmm.
People somehow want to talk about it.
Well, let me go back then.
I never volunteer about God or religion, but people feel compelled to talk about it.
Do you want to talk about that now?
I'm here for you. I just don't volunteer.
I don't
volunteer it.
Well, do you believe in God?
Your phone is ringing.
Sorry. Mm-hmm. That's a message.
I presume you pre-specified which God you're asking about.
Well, you can define God as you would, so...
No, you're the one who's asking the question.
Well, I'm saying...
So pick a God and ask me if I believe in that God.
Well, the Judeo-Christian God is not the...
Okay, if that God is, as described, being all-powerful and all-knowing and all-good, I don't see evidence for it anywhere in the world. So I remain unconvinced by... If that God, like I said, is all-powerful and all-good, I don't see that. I don't see it. Well, when a tsunami kills 250,000 people, or an earthquake kills 250,000 people, I'd like to think of good as something in the interest of your health and or your longevity. That's a pretty simple definition of something that is good for you, your health and your longevity. That's not a controversial understanding of the word good. So if Earth, in two separate events, separated by just a couple of years, can kill 500,000 people, then if the God as you described exists, then that God is either not all-powerful or not all-good. And so, therefore, I'm not convinced. Give me something more convincing,
well,
and we can have the conversation.
You're not convinced. Does that say you're still open because there's some other astrophysicists and biologists, I'm thinking of Richard Dawkins, I believe, and some others, who are very adamant about not engaging talk about a deity because they are convinced that a deity does not exist. Are you in that camp or are you in a third camp of people? I mean, I guess they're different camps, multiple camps, multiverse of camps.
I don't think of myself as being in any camp at all. If I'm in a camp, it's because someone decides that that's where I should be, rather than where I associate myself.
Do you think it's possible to, again, a cliche question, but can science and religion be reconciled in some way, or are they separate domains?
As religion is now practiced, and as science is now practiced, there is no intersection between the two.
Mm-hmm.
That is for certain.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not for want of trying.
Yeah.
There's been, over the centuries, many people, theologians as well as scientists, have tried to explore points of intersection. And any time someone has declared that harmony has risen up, it is the consequence of religion acquiescing to a scientific discovery. In every single case.
Accommodating, right, learning to accommodate it. Right?
Entirely.
Yes.
There is no point where the scientific discovery of the natural world says, oh, religion's got it different. We better change what our story is so that it matches the religion and then we can harmonize. No, that's never happened.
Well, do you see religion dying off? Is it on some kind of a decline or an asymptote and going to get closer and closer to being out of existence?
It depends what you mean by dying off. Most of Europe is atheistic right now.
Mm-hmm.
Even Italy, the seat of the Vatican, most people never go to church and don't reference their life to religious principles. The Netherlands is essentially 100% atheist. The churches are relics of a time when the church mattered in culture and in society and in governance. So the trend line in the Western world is that the influence of religion is diminishing. That's just a fact. I don't care whether it rises or falls. It doesn't matter to me.
Do you foresee any...
People, belief systems, I don't chase after them about it. It really doesn't matter to me.
Well, do you foresee any danger
for example,
if religion goes away?
Wait. So, for example, in the United States, one of its founding principles was that you can have the free expression of your religion or the absence of a religion. That is assured because God is not mentioned anywhere in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Actually mentioned in one trivial place. It's not mentioned in any important way in the Constitution. That ensures that the government cannot decide who you worship. And that stimulated a flux of people from all around the world so they can come here and express their religious freedoms. That, in many ways, defined the America that we've come to know and love. So I'm not going to sit here and tell you how religious you should be or whether you should be religious at all. It is not my fight. It is not my interest. I don't care. I really don't.
Hmm.
That's why I don't volunteer. I don't go out of my way to talk about it. Well, be religious. That's fine. I don't have a problem.
One thing that religion, I guess, does is gives people a sense of awe and wonder. It's not the only way to get that sense, right? You would argue.
I would say it's not only not the only way, it's not the best way.
The best way being scientific.
Well, awe. Best in the sense that you can have awe of the universe, and it has the benefit of being objectively verifiable. And this is an awe that will continue even after discoveries are made, because you find yourself on new vistas where more awe comes to you. You're not being awed at the same thing that your ancestors were. You've moved on.
But is there a kind of a weird intersection between, say, religious awe and scientific awe?
I think it stimulates, well, I don't know, I'm not a neuroscientist, but I prompted them to do the experiment to see if the awe that each camp, a spiritually religious community and a scientifically spiritual community, whether their awe stimulates the same part of the brain as one another. That'd be an interesting test. And I pose the question to them.
Right. Let me ask you one question.
So you want to say that's an intersection of science and religion? Sure. That could be one of these intersection points. But you're not going to your religious text to get insight into the physical universe. That has never happened successfully. So therefore, you'd have to conduct religion differently or science differently if you have as a priority that these two spheres of human conduct will intersect harmoniously.
So let me ask you about what gives you the greatest sense of awe. But first, I mean, you're famous for some wonderful phrases, one of which is, you're stardust, we're all stardust. You point out how we're all the product of these heavy elements, which were originally parts of dying stars.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So is there a single fact about space or the universe or about astrophysics that you find particularly awesome or inspiring?
Well, there are two. There's one, something that we know, and then something that we don't know. And what we know is actually my highest viewed YouTube presence. It's, if you Google most astonishing fact, that was a question asked of me by a Time magazine reporter in this office. And it sat there on the internet. You know, you'd have to get to it and know that it's there, and you'd listen to my answer. Some videographer with too much time on his hands decided to create visual splendiferous imagery to my answer, and right. It's now rising through 6 million views.
Right.
And it relates to the formation of the heavy elements in stars landing inside the human body and all life on Earth. So I recommend your listeners view that or possibly link to it on HuffPo.
Yeah.
In terms of most astonishing fact about which we know nothing, I think it's great. There are these profound, there's dark matter and dark energy. We don't know what either of them are. We measure their existence, but we don't know what's causing it. And you combine them, it's 96% of all that drives the universe. So everything we know and love about the universe and all laws of physics as they apply to 4% of the universe. That's stunning. It is as humbling a fact as there is.
Is there a quick way to differentiate dark matter and dark energy? Because I don't think I'm fully...
The problem is in them the same word appears, giving the listener the impression that they have something to do with one another. If they do have something to do with one another, it's nothing that's been revealed so far. Mm. Dark matter should really be called dark gravity. 85% of all the gravity in the universe has no known origin. We call it dark matter, but we don't even know if it's matter.
Right.
We just call it Fred. Dark energy, there's a mysterious pressure in the vacuum of space making the universe accelerate against the wishes, the gravitational urges of all the collective galaxies in the universe. We don't know what's causing that either. We call it dark energy.
So one.
It's 96% of the universe.
It's mind-boggling. I mean, you have to accept same way. I mean, you accept it on faith in a weird way that there's going to be an answer. I'm not saying there are verifiable observations, but you've kind of got this sense that I don't understand this, I can't understand it, but it's going to be explained to me at some point.
Well, so if you want to use the word faith in that way, sure, but I typically when faith is used in modern society, it has a strong association with religion.
Right.
And the belief that something exists that others can't objectively verify, so therefore it's a very personal thing for the person who expresses this concept of faith. In that case, I would say the history of science shows that great mysteries get solved. So I have confidence based on past experience that I can and should proceed with exploring the answer to those questions.
So
it may be that there's an answer that humans are too stupid to understand. That's possible too, and I'm especially intrigued by that possibility.
Well, what would that mean? What does that mean?
It means,
because there are already a lot of people who are too stupid to understand quantum mechanics, right?
That's, yeah, but as a species, if we can't, if the human brain, there may be problems out there that the human brain simply can't solve because we're not smart enough. That intrigues me to no end.
And will we be able to create brains that are smarter than we are?
That's an interesting question, possibly. If we know what's making us smart, go tweak the DNA or tweak the genome in some way. Sure.
Are you interested in these, and this is a bit off topic, but are you interested in these ideas of recreating a human brain in silicon, in semiconductor material to live on indefinitely in some kind of robotic form? Does that intrigue you at all?
I think it's... I need to speak to the guy who's proffering these ideas. Ray Kurzweil is his name. I have to have a conversation because I know he's a smart guy, and the objections I have to his ideas presumably have come up before, and presumably he has answers to them. But until that day happens, I can tell you that I don't see anything different from a computer that has all the neurosynaptic power that the human mind has. I don't see that as an important day any more than the day a machine replaced you on the assembly line, the day a machine replaced your oxen, the day a machine beat us at chess, the day a machine beat us at Jeopardy. It's fun and intriguing. We should pat ourselves on the back, but
it's not immortality.
It's not to assert that all of life is going to be different or that it's immortality. Fact is, the human brain is not as good a machine as we can make. The human brain has a lot of baggage, a lot of evolutionary baggage that's sort of delicately poised to not work. Perhaps creativity has to reach in the parts that don't work and come up with a new idea that doesn't base itself in anything anybody's ever measured, because now you have a brand new thought. Is that what Van Gogh reached in and made that painting? Is that where
Starry Night, yeah, yeah.
So, if I make a perfect map of your brain and then I send it off, does that brain go to the Bahamas on your next vacation and meet a new person? No, that brain is stuck in that moment that you uploaded it. So, is that you? No, it's not you, because you're continually living every minute that you're alive. We're in this interview. Did the brain that you uploaded before you walked in this door, is that still you? No, because now you includes this interview. You're a different person because we've just had a conversation. So I don't know what he means by this.
Right. Well, let me ask you, you mentioned...
You create a whole community of brains frozen in time.
Well, presumably they'd be able to grow and adapt and learn in the same way that...
Then they're a different person from you. Sure.
But
let them grow and adapt. But it's not you gaining immortality. It's a map of you at some instant in time that becomes some other person because it's having life experience that you're not having. Don't tell me it's you with immortality.
Then it gets to the same idea of cloning, right? That a clone of you, if it were created, it wouldn't be you.
Your twin is not you. Right. We've kind of figured that one out already.
Right. So you mentioned something before that intrigued me. You said that you had talked, I think that you must talk to scientists in different areas and give them your ideas. Are there particular interests that you have that people might be surprised to learn about in terms of your...
Scientific interests?
Well, anything. What you've been interviewed a million times.
Mm-hmm.
You've said a lot of stuff, and what is something that people would be surprised to learn about you?
That...
About it in any way.
If I had another life, I would be a librettist for Broadway musicals.
Really?
Yeah. Another life. Not this life. Still too much to do in this
life. Do you have a favorite musical?
I love musicals.
A particular one or ones?
I have about five favorites.
You want to mention any?
Yeah, sure. My Fair Lady. West Side Story. Jesus Christ Superstar. And in film, All That Jazz. count that as a musical. All That Jazz was also a musical, but it's not the film. They're separate creative products. So on Broadway, All That Jazz was a musical review. In film, All That Jazz is a semi-biographical, right, autobiographical story of Bob Fosse. So I would say those are my top three.
So do you go to Broadway a lot?
Yeah.
See a lot? Is there anything? What do you do in your spare time when you're not having deep thoughts about astrophysics?
Or on Broadway?
So I go to plays with my wife and Broadway musicals with the whole family. And we just saw Glass Menagerie with the family a couple of nights ago. That was just a couple of nights ago. We have tickets to who's the brilliant little girl? Roald Dahl's girl, Matilda. We're going to see Matilda. Yeah, right. Yeah. And we saw Romeo and Juliet recently with the dude's name who was in Pirates of the Caribbean. So we get to Broadway,
right?
We both cook and enjoy good wine with good food. And the great frustration is the better we are in the kitchen, the fewer restaurants become available to us to eat at.
Because you don't care about them as much.
Because we make better food than they make. Or I serve better wine.
Do you have a killer lasagna or something?
My wife has a killer lasagna. Oh, my gosh.
What's your killer dish?
I make a pistachio mint encrusted rack of lamb. That one you pull out. You reach for your better bottle of wine when you do that. Now I can't order a rack of lamb in a restaurant anymore.
Because it's not as good.
It's just not as good.
Mm-hmm. So you have a sense of awe and wonder at your rack of lamb.
No, I have a sense of awe and wonder at the food still made by master chefs that I will never figure out.
Right. Well, just quickly, going back to Cosmos, is there, and I believe you said that it airs on the 9th of March?
In prime time, 9 p.m., March 9th, it's a Sunday.
Right, and on what network?
Fox.
Okay.
And then around the world, like I said, in 171
that's amazing.
Countries.
Amazing.
In 45 languages, all within 72 hours of the airing of that first episode.
I don't think I can name that many languages.
I know, I didn't, or that many countries. I didn't know. You know, 171 countries. How many countries walk into the Olympics, you know?
Yeah.
I'd have to count and see.
I don't know. Maybe it'll be the Cosmos Olympics. Is there a last question. Is there any specific fact in Cosmos that you want to kind of tease us with? Is there something in one moment that you're particularly proud of in that
You will series? Learn. We tell the stories of hand-picked scientists in different cultures and different eras whose life work became the whose life work was fought against by the culture in which they operated, by the governments that controlled their lives, or by other social mores that interfered with their exploration of the truth. And so you will learn that scientists are not just the dispassioned lab coat donning persons, people that you don't otherwise care who they are or whether they have a home life, people who led tortured lives in search of the truth, some of whom gave their lives for having found the truth. Mm-hmm. And in that world, you learn that there are science martyrs. There are people who cared more about the truth than their own relationship to their homeland. And some of these are moving stories that while they're going, we retell them, and I'm in voiceover, I'm your guide through these stories as they are captured. Most of those stories are done in animation, in a kind of a graphic novel kind of animation. Mm-hmm. And that frees the set design.
That's the end of the first part of this two-part interview.
Period chandelier in what you tried to recreate in 1760? It's like, just get over yourself.
Right.
Hmm.
Well, thank you very much. Well, I look forward to seeing that. I'm sure it's
going
to be
very interesting. Thank you for your interest.
And thank you so much. What a fascinating conversation.
Yeah.
And such a treat to talk to you. So, thank you.
And if you really did upload your brain before this conversation,
I did.
It's no longer you.
Okay. Science Insider with David Freeman, the senior science editor of the Huffington Post, produced in cooperation with Robinhood Radio, robinhoodradio.com, on the web.